Welcome to Headlines. This week we have a fascinating guest. His name is Rabbi Meir Rabbi, and he's from Australia. And he's going to be speaking about something that he's actually put into effect. He's a big Talmud Chacham, and he has created Ben Pekua Farm, which will allow people, assuming that halachically it's upheld, to not only eat every part, it'll be the acharayim, and you'll be able to have filet mignon. Chaylev would be mutter, the way he's suggesting to do it. And we do have to give a shout out to Ari Spiegler, who actually sent me the email suggesting, he said, it's controversial, it's being discussed, it's cutting edge, you should definitely find out about it. So thank you, Ari, for suggesting to call the innovator of this topic, and we're going to interview Rabbi Meir Rabbi tonight. We will also have Rabbi Levine, and he runs a very interesting organization, a chesed organization. This is on our ongoing. We try to do halacha, and we speak about people who really partner with Kav Yachal in helping the broken, the fatzaret. And what he runs an organization called Dror, like Ukarasim Dror Baris, and this is for the families of men who are incarcerated for doing less than for doing what's the reprehensible, and their families suffer greatly, both financially, they suffer culturally, they suffer socially, and they didn't do anything. These children have no idea why they can't get a winter coat, why there's no food on the table, or maybe why they're being socially scorned. So Dror is a support group for the families of those who are incarcerated. We'll be just talking to him as well. I would like to read a few letters about that we've gotten that I thought were interesting. One, we got a letter from Rabbi Heshi Zeltzer, and it had to do with the interview that we had with Rabbi Meiselman. And the letter reads as follows. Dear Mr. Lichtenstein, Rabbi Meiselman said, as per your question, that whereas Ravina and Ravashi, who lived circa 500, could make no mistake, the Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim, or the Nasi, who were basically there during Kabbalah HaTorah, could make a mistake. Do you think that this is correct? Well, I think, Rabbi Zeltzer, you hit on a really powerful point, because don't we have a klal in Kabbalah HaTorah that we say, Harishayim kemalachim anu kechamayrim, and they are so much greater. The difference between the Rishayim and us is just huge. It's the gap. They are that much closer to Kabbalah Satira. To say that somebody who lived 1,500 years post Kabbalah Satira is infallible, right? Whereas the Beis Din HaGadol, and this is the law in Vayikra, you have a Nasi Kisechta, or the Nasi who makes a mistake, can make a mistake, does seem to go against the entire Messiris of Kabbalah Satira, and that is really very questionable. And halachically, we know that Ein Bezdin Yachal Avatal, Bezdin, a Bezdin cannot be Mavatal, the words of a Bezdin that preceded it. So how could Ravine and Ravashi, so it's the same concept that those that lived before us, the prior generations, are greater than ours. We are not Chaylik and Rebbe Kivega, or the Gra, and the Achrayim are not Chaylik and the Rishayim, and the Rishayim were not Chaylik and the Gainim, and the Gainim were not Chaylik and Rabban and Savroi, who were not Chaylik and the Tanoim, who were not Chaylik and Amroim. So to say that suddenly it's gone the exact opposite direction, it's really very problematic, what Rabbi Meiselman is saying. I agree with you, Rabbi Zeltzer. Now, I'd like to change topics. You know, a number of weeks ago, it was noted in the press that I was going to be holding a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, and I got a number of letters. I'll read one of the letters on the air. This letter is from Yechiel Aberbach. Dear Mr. Lichtenstein, I read on the Yeshiva World about the shameful event that you are hosting. I started to immediately wonder, who is the idiot who would do such a thing, I soon realized it was you. I could not believe it. In the blink of an eye, my opinion of you has been turned upside down. Until now, I have been listening often to your program on Matzah Shabbos, as well as have been promoting it to others. Thank you so much, Yechiel. Since then, I unfortunately lost all respect for you. I have absolutely no desire to do it any longer. How could you support such a lady to become president of this country and people waste their hard-earned money on somebody so corrupt and dishonest? Don't you see right through her? Someone with no integrity will have absolutely no feelings of gratitude. Since you are apparently not aware of the dangers we face, should she, God forbid, become president, please read the attached article. It is one of many, many articles that should make you want to stay far away from this person, who should actually have been put away in prison for endangering the country. And he attaches a letter, an article about Linda Tripp, who was involved with the... Linda Tripp was worked... in some minor level, she was a minor functionary with Monica Lewinsky, etc. She was the one who went to the press about Monica Lewinsky against President Clinton. So, thank you, Yechiel, for expressing your opinion. And I responded to him in writing, but I'll just tell you over the air why I responded. I said, for starters, I mean, anybody in a position of power gains enemies. And Linda Tripp, who's done everything she could to undermine the entire Clinton presidency. I mean, this is somebody who obviously has an axe to grind, who wrote books about it, who, you know, there's certainly no shortage of people, Republicans, who hate both people of power and certainly Democrats. But Rabbi Menachem Ginak, who is really the Rav HaMachshir of America, anybody who's listening to this program and anybody who eats kosher in this country is Seimach on Rabbi Menachem Ginak, whose integrity is towering. That's how I've heard him described, the person of towering integrity. And even if you eat the quote-unquote Hasidish Hechsherim, like Ungers and Glicks and, I don't know their names, Teitelbaums and Schwartzes, etc., they cannot exist without using, because products today are a composite, are an agglomeration of so many different multitudinous, of so many different components. They all use the OU's Hechsher for some component, and he is the Machsher of America. So whereas Linda Tripp has sour grapes, a bitter, angry person, and if you listen to the great, endless Lashon Hara machines known as, you know, right-wing radio, which it's just full of hate. It's like almost turning on the toilet when you open the radio and listen to people like Rush Limbaugh, a man married and divorced three times, who's coming to teach America about fidelity and honestly a drug addict. But when you take that all away, Reb Menachem Ginak says, he says, I know the Clinton for 25 years. And he says, they have nothing but the nicest things to say about our brethren. And he was considered one of the greatest supporters of Israel in our lifetime. And he says that Hillary stands side by side with him in her dais. Right? They have a son-in-law who's Jewish. Many of their friends are Jewish. Some of their very best friends, and there is no reason to believe that she would be any different. Now, additionally, we as a tzibur have to recognize that there is a reasonable chance that she will be president, and for us to have not any, you know, friends who support her is not the brightest position as a community that we could take. So last night we had this event for Hillary, and I can tell you that it was sold out. In other words, it was jam-packed. We were turning people away who, you know, weren't within 24 hours, didn't get Secret Service clearance. So we actually turned away many people. I think many people told me it was a Kiddush Hashem. And let me tell you what I said, because I think that, you know, you may be interested. And when I introduced her, I said, you know, we're coming to elect the leader of the free world. What attributes should a leader have? So let's go to the Torah and see what are the attributes. We see Moshe Rabbeinu is the leader. He's Moshe Reya Mehemna. Reish is the manig of Klal Yisrael, right? What do we know about Moshe? Moshe went out to his brethren. Vayigdal hayelad, and the child became old. It's a shiloh. Was he 13? Was he older than that? And he went out to his brethren. Vayarbis of loisam. What did he do? He sees dirty slaves, filthy, beaten, and he feels it. He calls them his brothers. Interesting. Why would he? There's some empathy here. He's going down. It's definitely Nechayis Darga. And what happens next? He sees a taskmaster. He sees an Egyptian taskmaster beating a slave. Now, what would happen if he intervenes? He puts his life at risk. He may have to run for his life, which he ultimately does. But what does he do? He strikes the Egyptian. He says, you cannot strike a slave. That's not fear. That's wrong. That's a terrible act. That's heinous. And what does he do the next day? Again he goes out. And he sees one yid striking another. Evil one! Why do you strike your brother, the weaker brother, who can't protect himself, who can't defend himself adequately? Now, why does it bring both stories? And it's possible. The first story, you may say, you know, wow, it's empathy. He really, compassion. But then you'll say, no, nationalism. It's an Egyptian, it's a Mitzri. And an Ivri, he decided nationalism, Ivri. Maybe that's not a sign of compassion. Maybe it's pride. The next day, it's two of his brothers, two Hebrews, two Yidden, striking one the other. And again, he puts his life at risk. Now it's not nationalism. It's standing up for the disadvantaged, the outcast, the deprived, the weak, putting his life at risk, which he did. He has to run for his life. He spends the next, according to Chazal, different opinions, and he plays from 67 some odd years in the desert. Why? Because he had what midah? Compassion. Empathy for another person. This is what a manig is. This is how the Torah describes leadership. And when you think of it, right, where did he get this from? Remember, he never met his mother. He was 3 months old when she put him into the Yamsuf. Right, when she put him in a little casket into the Nile, right? She put him into Vatosem Basuf al Sfasa Yar. She put him into the reeds, and he started to float. Vateisatzev Achosem Erochik. His sister stood there to see Ledoyam Al Yosaloi. What's going to happen? And the daughter of the Pharaoh, right, comes Lirchaitz Al Yar. And what does she see? Vataris Ateva Vatishlach Samasa. She made a great effort, according to Rashi. And she opens it up, v'hinei nar b'icha. A child is crying, an infant, and she says it's a Jewish child. Now think of it. This is Nazi Germany, circa 1943. She is the daughter of the Pharaoh. What happens for hiding, right, an illegal? Dangerous. It's a time of darkness, a time of genocide, anti-Semitism, misogyny, hatred. Right? This is not a good time. But what does she do? She has courage. First, she says, Vatachmel. She has compassion. She, it hurts her to see somebody else, even if it, life is in danger. A righteous Gentile. And what does she do? She saves him. This is the chinuch that Moshe got. She was his stepmother, Basya Baspare. So a Gentile woman saved Moshe Rabbeinu, and allowed him to become Rosh Hashanah. He stands on the shoulders of a woman who was not Jewish, but who had great compassion, and she was, in effect, the stepmother of Moshe. She taught him compassion. So what do we know about the leader? The leader has the attribute, is compassion, is empathy, a sense of right, a sense of fairness. And as I said, when we elect a leader of the free world, that's really what we are looking for. And I think that she really, people told me that she was smiling and nodding and, you know, agreed with the Dvar Torah. I closed off by saying one thing. I said, you know, the leading Republican candidate, who so many people are inspired with, this is a quote that from him. He said, and as Jews, how can we tolerate this? He says, greed is good. You can't be too greedy. You can't own enough. Take everything you can. Here's a quote from Clinton that she said when she was 14. She heard it from her teacher. She said it changed her life. And this is the quote. Do all the good you can to whomever you can in as many ways as you can, however you can, for as long ever as you can. Which one exemplifies our value system best? Let's go to our guests. I want to remind you all that we now have a new time slot. We are now Tuesday evening on WSNR at 7 p.m. So if you're driving home, you can listen to us on the drive home. Or if you're putting the kids to sleep and you want to hear something else interesting on the radio, turn it on. WSNR, 6:20 a.m. Besides our regular times, we actually have a new time. Let's go to the phones. We have on the phone with us, from Australia, 16 time zones away, it is 16 hours ahead in Australia, Rabbi Meir Rabbi, who has really created an incredible new concept in Kashrus that I would like him to describe to you directly. Welcome, Rabbi Rabbi.
Shalom Aleichem. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Thank you. Rabbi Rabbi, could you tell our listeners what the Ben Pekua Farm, your concept, and the halachic basis? Tell us, give us a little background.
In a nutshell, it's a bit difficult to do. Even in a coconut shell, it's a bit difficult to do. But I'll try to start with an illustration of a parallel halacha. An egg laid by a chicken goes through a number of stages. In its early stages, it is fleshy. We treat it as being fleshy. Once the chick begins to form inside the shell, halacha maintains that that item is a sheret and carries many isurim. When the chick emerges from the shell, or according to another opinion, when it opens its eyes, it transitions from being a sheret, which is osur, to becoming an oif, which is kosher. This is a parallel. I'm not bringing this as a raya, but this is a parallel to the what happens with Ben Pekua. An uber inside its mother, a fetus, unborn inside its mother, a calf before it is born, is not classified as a behema as far as the halacha is concerned. The Gemara clearly states that Choshed Yodai, someone who does what we would consider today to be keyhole surgery and extracts the chalev fats from an uber, which is a ben tes chai, which is a fully gestated living fetus, and we take what will be considered to be the chalev fats from the hindquarters of that uber, the Gemara says those chalev fats are not chalev. And the question becomes, why? Why is it not chalev? And just to clarify, it is chalev when it is taken out, when it is, as the Gemara describes it, as yotza la'avir ha'olam. When it comes out, it's exposed to the environment beyond the mother, it becomes chalev. We pass the like Rabbi Yochanan, this is the Gemara Behemah Bekasha, this is Ein Dalet Avad Aleph. And the question is, why is it not chalev, or why does it only become chalev when it's yotzei la'avir ha'olam? So I'm drawing a parallel to what I said earlier about the chicken, and that means that it is a different item in the eyes of halacha and only changes if it has satisfied two conditions. The two conditions are that it's a ben tes, that it is fully gestated, and the second condition is that it's yotzei la'avir ha'olam, it is exposed to the environment outside the uterus of the mother. So these days, when we shecht animals, they need to go through a very careful and painstaking examination, particularly of the lungs, to to ensure that they are smooth, or halak, or we call them glatt. And if they do not qualify, then they are not kosher. There's a very high proportion of animals that are disqualified.
What proportion would that be, Rabbi?
It depends where it's being done, but we have heard from Poskim, Rabbonim working in Shchita, that could be as high as 2/3.
Wow. So it's they basically dispose of those. They send them to a non-kosher shlachtos. So obviously, all the expense of the shechita, etc., is in vain. It makes those that do qualify that much more expensive.
Yes, you've hit the nail on the head. That is correct. People don't understand that if the product is unsold to the non-kosher markets, which they have to do, it is an opportunity to recover costs, but it cannot recover the entire set of costs. When we run a kosher production, the production line needs to be slowed down in order to do all the bedikas, all the checking of the lungs, bedikas pnim and bedikas chutz. And besides that, there are many extra staff who are employed. The fats in the hindquarters particularly, chalav fats, they are also in our Torah, that's a biblical prohibition, and they need to be removed. And similarly, in the hindquarters in the leg, there is the gid hamoshe, the sciatic nerve, that also needs to be removed. The time required and the expertise and the cost, therefore, make it almost prohibitive to have ready access to hindquarter meats, because the nikur, the porging, removal of the chedev and the gid is extremely time-consuming and difficult. In the B'nai Bekur, third, there is no issue of chalav, and there is no issue of gid hamoshe.
Well, but the Shulchan Aruch says there is an issue of gid if it's midrabanan.
Excellent. So I'm about to launch in that. Thanks for the opportunity. The Chazal have made a gezeira, as one would expect, because of Marasayim, because of the way things look, and it creates the wrong impression. And Chazal are extremely concerned about these sorts of things. So Chazal were Gozer. They did make Gezeiros. And the Gezeiros they made is that the behemoth requires Shechita. And that's very important for us. We want to ensure that every single animal is shechted. And I must point out, the Shechita process itself is not the issue that creates the tremendous extra costs for kashrus. Shechita essentially requires 2 shochtim and maybe an overseer. So it's 2 or 3 people. The main additional extra costs come from the slowing of the process, which is not connected to the shechita, that's connected to the bedikas and other things I mentioned beforehand, the forging, the removal of the chalav and the gid. When Chazal made this gezeira of shechita, they also required in some, that this gezeira, first you have to recognize, applies almost in all circumstances, but not in all circumstances. And, for example, the Gemara says if it's prosos of plutos, if its hooves are fused, so there is a marker in the animal, so that being the case, it is exempt from the decree. Now, we have similar illustrations within the halachas of Maris Ayin. So within these sort of laws, for example, we are not allowed to drink blood. Fish blood is permitted. And if one wants to present fish blood at a table when one is eating, it's necessary to leave a sign there. The halacha describes leaving scales of the fish on the blood so it can be identified as being fish blood. And in those circumstances, there's no exam. It's mutter to drink that blood. So there's a similar type of exemption here where the animal has some sort of a marker in it. Prosos of Plutos is the illustration of the Gemara. What is surprising is that the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, the Beis Yosef, brings this point of the Gemara, the Halakha. The Ramah adds on to this and says, alternatively, Yesh bo shum sha'ar davar tamuah. Or alternatively, it has some minor unusual feature. Now, I've been to Raham Kanievsky, and I've had a number of meetings with him. And in fact, the Ramah, the source of the Ramah, who says any small feature is adequate, the source for this comes from the practice of the Gaonim.
Rav Shira Gaon, that's brought in the Gaos Ashri.
Correct. The source that is the Ozer Ruah. Ashura Gaon is quoted by the Gaos Ashri. They kept Azadei B'nai Bekua, they had many B'nai Bekua, and that's why I said that in my discussions and in my correspondence, written correspondence with Reb Chaim, it's quite clear that he understands that they had many of them, they had herds of them, they cultivated them. But the point I want to make is that the many animals that the Gaonim had did not have Prosos of Plutos. They didn't have this congenital blemish which is in the body of the animal. In fact, they didn't have a blemish at all, which was physical. It wasn't in the body of the animal at all. It certainly was not congenital from the time of birth. It was simply the fact that they did it the mokum knufia, at a public gathering, because they served this meat to the guests at weddings. It was a public gathering, the knufia, and it was there was a koil, there was an awareness. And in fact, this is the kasha that's asked by the Rosh that they're discussing over there. Is it because they think, they suspect at one time, there's an opinion, Rav Shimon Shuzuri in the Mishnah, who maintains that Chazal made no gezer of Maris Ein whatsoever. Now, I'm not a Baki the Shas, but I'm hard-pressed to find, and I've asked around many people, and I think even asked Rav Chaim. I'm not sure anymore about that. But as far as I can tell, there's no other example anywhere in Shas where there's a machlokes if there was at all a gzera made of Maris Ein. There might be places where there's a machlokes the extent of the gzera. But you have a machlokes where one day it says, no, Tanakama says there's a gzera of Maris Ein. Shemeshazuri says absolutely no gzera at all.
So wait, so Rabbi, so let me just sum up for the audience, okay? The halacha is that a ben pekua, which is a fetus that has not been born, when the mother is shechted, when the mother is nishchat kalacha, the ben pekua is mutter, and the ben pekua being mutter is means so midrab, it's mutter in everything. Gid chelev doesn't eat shechita. There's no tarfis. Midrabanan,
right.
It needs shechita.
It requires
shechita, and it requires gid and chelev, but no dine tarfus. So your idea is to create a herd of behemoths, of livestock, where they're all second generation ben pekuis, and they're sort of cordoned off from all other animals, because if it got integrated with another animal, it would create a great problem. Would be half ben pekua, half not, which would be treif, would not be able to shecht. And those behemoths, you would shecht them, and therefore there would be no dine tarfus in them. They would all be glatt kosher, because there's no dinim of treif in them. And therefore, on a simple societal level, you would be able to bring down the cost of meat substantially. And additionally, for example, Rav Herschel Schecht of Yeshiva University does not consume milk, I understand, because he holds that since they, for medical reasons, they give many animals, many livestock, shots in the stomach, so he believes that it makes them treifus, and therefore he won't drink milk, because he holds that all milk is a suffix, that it's coming from a treif, and it's more than 1 in 60, so it's not batel b'shishim. He would actually be able to drink the milk of these ben pekuas, because there's no dine tarfus. So this, what you're saying so far, is established halacha, right?
Yeah.
And it's, except for, just sort of almost gut feelings, it would be accepted by everybody. Now you're extending that further. You're saying, even though the Shulchan Aruch says that midrabanan, it's aser begid, you, gid hanash would be an iser rabanan, and there would be an iser chelev, You're saying that since the Gemara says that in a case of kolot, where the hoof is fused together and it's sort of a freaky animal, in such a case there's no maris ayin because it's famous, it becomes a koil, goes out over it. You want to say that a herd of behemoths would also be considered something strange, and therefore there would be no maris ayin, and therefore there would be no gid hanasha and no chaylev in these as well. Is that the point that you're making?
That's a very good summary, and it is correct, but it's not good enough for me.
Okay.
There is clearly a Shittas HaRambam who maintains that once the animal has come full term, it's fully gestated, he maintains that the Chalev and the Gid are also in HaTorah.
That's correct, yeah.
And this Shitta, although it's not brought in the Mechaber early on in Siyot Gimel, it's brought later on by the Ramah. So having the simonic market differences would not help the Shittas HaRambam. However, the Rambam agrees, everybody agrees, that this limitation applies only to a ben test, to a fully gestated animal. A non-fully gestated animal is completely different.
A ben ches has none of these halachas.
Correct. So to illustrate this point, I mentioned earlier, if we do a bit of keyhole surgery on a pregnant cow and take the chalev fats from the ur inside it, when those chalev fats emerge, they emerge beyond the uterus of the cow, after they become chalev nisudaraisa. But that applies only to a ben tes chai. We need two important conditions satisfied. The first condition is it's fully gestated, and the second condition is that it is alive. If we were to take out the chalev, do the identical procedure, but the chalev we're taking is not being taken from a living fetus, but the fetus is dead, all poskim would agree that the chalev, which is not chalev, that means the fats that come from the area in the uber that should be chalev will not be chalev, even when it's come out later. And the same is true if the uber is a ben ches, it's not fully gestated. Now, this is clear in the Nosa Kalin of the Rambam. I think it's Parak Hay. I'm not sure anymore offhand, but absolutely clear. So there's a clear distinction between a ben ches and a ben tes, which I've just illustrated. There are many other ways to verify and prove this as well. So the point is, in order to satisfy even the Shittas HaRambam, which in fact the Rambam says we should be chayshish for, we have gone to the trouble and the expense of ensuring that every single uber that we have used for the starting herd, and which we continue to feed the herd with, comes from a fetus which is taken from a shechted, glut, kosher behema, and the fetus is definitely not fully gestated. And in order to satisfy this,
so you're saying your original group was all B'nai Ches, you're saying, not B'nai Tes.
That is correct.
So the question to you, Rabbi, the question is, could you point to anybody in Halacha who opines that a Ben Ches who has an Uber that's a Ben Tes, right, that the same Kula of Ben Ches passes on intergenerationally?
Well, that is self-evident. It's self-evident from the astounding halacha that the Bnei Bonov, that the progeny of Bnei Pekua are also Bnei Pekua. And this is one of the primary questions that has plagued, if I might say, or mystified all Achronim and Rishonim. Because when the Gemara posits this halacha, that Bnei Bonov are Tzav Kol HaDoros, all future generations are Bnei Pekua, there is no source. There's no svara, there's no argument, there's no explanation given by the Gemara or the Rishonim or the Achronim. Now, we have a pasuk, Kol Asher Ba'Behema Tocheilu. It occurs twice in the Torah, with slight variations. The Gemara has a slight discussion. Is it the drosha and Kol Ba'Behema? Everything in the Behema is the drosha. Behema Ba'Behema, the animal inside the animal. Either way, it's impossible to make the leap from a hatter, a special hatter that allows you to eat the ben pekula. It is impossible to make the leap to say that therefore B'nai Bonov are also going to be Musar. There's no connection. Now, however, I have a soft explainer, and this is the foundation and the aside of Ashtigal Torah that was published in the recent Sefer of Tuchumim.
Which I saw, which created a lot of Lahagdal Torah Lahadir, created a big tumult in the world. If nothing else, Rabbi, you've sort of delved into an area in the Torah that has sort of been sleeping for the last thousand some odd years. And you've brought it alive, if nothing else than that.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll also make the point, I'm blushing.
No,
Your point is that,
in your piece you write that it's a beria bifnei atzmai, it's a beria chadasha, it's some type of a new type of a creature, and since it's a new type of a creature, it passes on intergenerationally.
That is correct.
But who says that the month passes on intergenerationally? Maybe just the concept of Ben Pekua, but 8 or 9 months to say that the date of birth passes on intergenerationally, that is still a Chiddush.
Well, it's not the date of birth that passes on. It's not the date of birth. It is the Metzius and the Mulchus of what the animal is. So I'll just make the point that this is not something I'm saying smach my own svara. This is something that I discussed and I wrote about to Rav Chaim, and he confirmed this both verbally and in writing.
But none of the paiskim say this. Interestingly, the Taz, the Shach, the Gra, the Rabbi Kivega, none of them note that the 8th month would pass on generationally to the next group.
So, but we do note that there is a distinction between the Ben Chas and the Ben Chas.
Yes, absolutely.
The Chazal made a gezeira on the Ben Chas.
And not on the Ben Chas. So the question is, a Ben Chas who then was this gadol would gave birth.
Yes.
So the question is, would that child have the mile of the Ben Chas or the Ben Chas? It doesn't say the Shulchan Aruch. It doesn't address it.
That is correct. I have searched. And as I said, I would be extremely reluctant to practically suggest that this should be something which is a lechatchila and a lemahadrin without having received confirmation in my discussions and in my written communications with the Rav Chaim.
So, let me ask you, so are you suggesting when you want to do your Ben Pekua herd, there's two parts to what you want to do. One is the Ben Pekua for Tarfis. And then you have a Chiddush that, as far as Gid Hanasha, Chelev, Ben Ches, do you want to implement both? Do you want to implement half of it? What is your plan in your farm?
The plan is to implement both of them because I have absolute confidence that this is the correct track. And as I said, this is not something that I did not consider myself a Paisuk, but I sort of consider that I've had a very clear and confirmed communications with Rav Chaim, and made it quite clear that the Gaonim were also feeding from the B'nai Bonov, the herd that they cultivated. They were also feeding the Chaylev and the Gid, and that was absolutely confirmed. And
where does that say? That Gaonim Sashri does not write that. Where do you get that from?
Now, what I just said now is that I've had conversations and written communications with Rav Chaim. It was the framework of our discussion was that event of the Gaonim. So I first verified with Rav Chaim that they were also breeding and cultivating herds of B'nai Tekua. And the next component was that in those cultivated herds of B'nai Tekua that they fed the Hamayimam at the Knutches, at the Chuppas, they were also feeding them the Chedek Acharayim.
But how did Reb Chaim know that? Where does he get that from? Because the Hagayis Sashri that we have does not say that.
As I agree with you, the Loshen, one of them said, Shnei Bebekuas, not Mashma, but when it says the Loshen of the Ozerua is Harbei, so that is implied. I wanted a bit of confirmation. Rav Chaim agreed with this. And I would consider Rav Chaim to be a satisfactory opinion for me to rely upon and for other people to rely upon. So in Svara, I think it is Mufas, and I would say that Reb Chaim agrees with this, and Reb Chaim has put his name to this.
So would Reb Chaim put it into writing? I'm curious.
Yes, I said I have a written communication from Reb Chaim regarding a number of issues, including the question about what precisely it was that the Goyim were doing. And A, we confirmed that they were breeding herds of vapor cooler, so they had an abundance. And second of all, when they fed the Hamoyim at the Chuppas, they fed them the Chelek HaChorayim without making nikur of the Cheder or the Gid. They fed them at the incomplete.
Rabbi, could you, in your article, you say you believe the meat is parv. Is that how, do you believe that to be the case?
Oh, absolutely. I don't like the idea of suggesting that people should be cooking both Rechalov. That's not my intention at all. But I do use that in order to highlight dramatically that the Ben Bekur is a min bifnei atzmai.
But Rabbi, so, you source a meishachachma as the source that it would be parv. So
yes.
The question would be like this. Ben Pekua, no Rishon or Achron from the time of the Gemara for 1,500 years suggested that the meat would be parv. And the way I and many others read the Meshech Achma, the Meshech Achma is not suggesting that the meat is parv. He's suggesting that the milk is parv. And he brings as a raya, he brings as his makor, he brings the Shara Melech. And it's a very famous Shara Melech that Rabbi Kiva Eger discusses, that actually discusses, should the milk be parv? So what source would you quote that the meat is parv?
Okay, I understand that and I accept that. The reading of the Meshech Chochma is a bit vague and it can be read as suggesting that the Cholov is Cholov Shchutzah. And we know that the Machlaikas, this way and that way. If it is Cholov Shchutzah or not Cholov Shchutzah, and the Machlaikas depends on the definition of Chalev Imoy. We dash, and why is Cholov Shchutzah not Milchik? Because the Isra is Lo Savash Al Gidib Chalev Imoy. So we go on dashing, if it's capable of being another, so if it's alive,
it can't be a name.
If it's capable of being another, if it's shechted, it can't be another, therefore it's not halal, it can cook. So the question becomes, is the status of a bent bekul being nashat kashkuta, does all the nipples parvel, or do you say, no, it's the royal yoisein? Okay, I understand this. But I want to make the observation that I would, first of all, I would discuss this, as you can imagine, with any number of bonim that I've been to visit in Israel and America and everywhere else I've been on the phone to. But there's no question that Rav Moshe Sternbach, in his Sefer Moedim Uzmanim, actually says these words. He's actually quoting and discussing the Meshech Chochma, and he presents it as a double litzla, and he uses it to say, suggest another reason why we eat milchigs on Shavuos. He says, because the core of the whole Meshech Chochma is that when Moshe Rabbeinu was Olah L'Morim to take the Torah to Bnei Israel, the Malachim were making a Havganah, they were protesting, and Moshe Rabbeinu is silent, holding on to the Kisei HaKavod, and Abisha says, Harzeh Lahem Teshuvah. I'm not sure if Moshe gives the answer, or Abisha gives the answer, but the answer is a Halsem Bosa B'chol of Eitzel Avraham Avinu. It's to do with that. So Moshe says, because the argument which gave the Yidden the Torah was Cholov, that's the meaning to eat Cholov. So when I say this on Shulis every year, my children always respond to me, in that case, the meaning should be to eat Bosa B'chalov on Shulis, not to eat Cholov.
Right.
But that's just a bit of a vitz. But in discussing this issue, when Ramesh Sternbach rewords the Meshech Chochma and explains it, he writes these words. He writes, Hashchita matir beben pekua v'shari b'cholov. Which means that the shchita of the mother...
Ramesh Sternbach is a contemporary. You could ask him. I mean, but the Meshech Chochma brings...
The
Shara Melech, and the Shara Melech, which is the source of the Meshech Chochma, is talking about the milk, not the meat. So, I mean,
I accept your kasha. I really do. And to me, it's a milk to the tamir, and I have maybe a mahalach or two. But You know, with the kashya stat minished.
So I'm saying, so you're bringing your sources, your source for this heta, which should be from a Tana, or at the very least a Rishon, is Ramosha Sternberg.
Yes. That is correct. I have not suggested or proposed that any Rishon has said that it's parable. I simply said this is a consideration put forward by Reb Chaim, I beg your pardon, by the Meshach Chochmah. Meshach Chochmah is a bit vague. I accepted that. It's confirmed clearly from what Ramosha Sternbach says that he understands the Meshach Chochmah. He's not speaking about the Cholov, but speaking about the Basar. I've been into Ramosha Sternbach. My kasha was not about this. My kasha was, is this a Das Yachid? And his response to me was, that dingzach. That was his response to me. And the same week, I popped in to visit again at Reb Chaim, and it wasn't I, it was another one who was with me, who had heard my outrageous suggestion that the fallacious parva, and he asked Reb Chaim, and Reb Chaim says, kosher v'yosher.
You need a Tana for this, or a Rishon for this, or Rabbi Kiva Eger for this. You can't mention that the Rav on the corner said that something that hasn't been said for 1,500 years to change the status of beef. I mean, it doesn't work that way in halacha.
I'm inclined to agree with you. I honestly, I'm not suggesting l'maisa that we should be cooking basar b'cholov. As I said, and I'm glad you mentioned this.
I'm saying for this, you don't need Rav Moshe Sternbach. You need Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, to change the status of beef.
We can be mefalpa and discuss this. And I do not dismiss what you're saying.
But the bottom line is, your first concept of a Ben Pekua farm would gravamen of your point would dramatically decrease and make meat. I mean, if you go to meat in the supermarket that's kosher and non-kosher, it could be three times the cost. You're saying
correct.
If we would accept your concept, it would make it, if it wouldn't be three times the cost, it would be 20% more rather than 300% the cost. And many people maybe who would be nichshel and tarfas because they just don't want to afford kashrus, it could come that you would allow them to eat kosher and be save yidin from the nichshel. That is the gravamen of your argument. Without getting into like the power of or not, which let's not get in. Am I correct?
You hit the nail on the head precisely. Our ambition and our purpose really is to welcome back. We always know that there's a spike in the sales of kosher flesh when it comes to Pesach and Yom Tovim in general. We know that. Well, as I describe it, there is an enormous interest in people who are sympathetic to kashrus, and that they're either put off by the prices or they're put off by the inability to have transparency in the prices, or they don't like the quality of the meat because they can't get hind quarter cuts, whatever it is. There's a number of reasons. But all those are overcome by establishing a herd of B'nai Pekua. And you must understand, with the B'nai Pekua in a schlachthaus, if we put in 100 animals, 100 animals come out that are all kosher gluts.
Astonishing.
100%. And we can do that. So we have 100 animals in the time that it takes ordinary kashrus five times the amount of time or six times the amount of time to produce the same amount of meat. And they can't use the hindquarters either. You know, you spoke beforehand about the costs which we suffer because when we sell the meat we've produced in the kosher system, it's more expensive and we cannot recover those costs. Of the two rabbis were both working in the meat industry in kashrus, and they both gave me a statistic that I will repeat to you, but I cannot believe it myself. They've told me that up to 80% of the meat that is processed within the framework of kashrus, up to 80% cannot be sold as kosher flesh.
Wow, astonishing.
If you accumulate the hindquarters of all the animals, and the ones that are traced, you have 80%. It's a shocking. So 20%, in a sense, is subsidizing the 80%.
It's astonishing.
It is astonishing.
It's astonishing.
It's tragic. Yeah.
Well, Rabbi, thank you very much. And even though I'm not sure Ben Pekua meat will ever make it to America, I do want to thank you because after I read your Shtickle Torah, I actually, you know, they couldn't get me out of my study for the next 3 days in a row. I was so fascinated by a corner of Torah that had been forgotten for so many years that you cast a light on, and it caused many articles to be written about it after you. So a big masu matin, b'halacha, and I want to thank you and wish you hatzlacha in all your endeavors. Well, let's go to our next guest, who is, you know, we always like to have the halacha portion, and we like to have the chesed portion, the people who, you know, olam chesed yibane. So let's go to our phone and listen to somebody who does really remarkable work. We have on the phone with us Rabbi Yoel Levin, who's the director of Dror, and we will, rather than me tell you what Dror does, we will ask Rabbi Levin to describe it to us. Welcome, Rabbi Levin.
Yeah, to be exact, it's Levin, L-A-B-I-N.
Levin. So, Rabbi Levin, could you tell us what Dror does?
Dror helps Jewish families where the father or one of the parents is in jail. Helping the families, being there, giving a helping hand.
Rabbi Levin, how did you get, what inspired you to get involved with this?
I had a friend who was locked up. So I helped him together with some other friends. And then I saw that the wife has to talk every day to five other askanim to find out what's going on with the husband, to send something to the jail, or every step in the way how hard it was, or to put in the young kid in a cheder when the father is not home because he's in jail. We saw all the struggles, and we saw that a lot of people are doing so much good things. There's a lot of good Askonim and rabbis who try to help, but it's not an organized matter. It wasn't the headquarters, a place where we would say we will try to do anything. I mean, we'll try to do everything. We'll try to do whatever we can. We're not paying for lawyers. This is something that's important to know because, I mean, this is millions of dollars. We're not talking something we can't save all the Jews with lawyers, but we'll try to help. We have a couple of people who understand law, understand the system. They will advise what lawyer to take and what steps to take.
How large of a staff does Dror have?
We are all volunteers. It's not a paid staff, and I'm also a volunteer. We're all coming in a couple of times a week or some days when it's really hectic. We have this phone service. A couple of volunteers are having their time, their day or night to keep the phone. But we're all volunteers. Besides one secretary, it's all volunteers. So the money is going straight to the family. So we're not a big organization, but a very good organization.
So Rabbi Levin, is it fair to say, you know, there's a story they say over from the Baal Shem Tov, they say over that there was one of his Talmidim was the Rebbe of the Ganovim. He said, everybody, Shlomo Kalbach used to say this story, he said, everybody wants to be the rabbi of the rich, of the famous, the Hollywood rabbi, the rabbi right. to the stars. Nobody wants to be the rabbi of the prisoners.
Right.
So it seems that you and your staff has taken a job that you're certainly not doing this for honor, you're not doing this for kavod, you're not going to get shishi or shlishi in shul. This is truly an avodah l'shem shamayim. Is that fair to say?
Right. Of course. Thanks for saying this. It's hard work, and it's very important to hear some good words. But I want to add that I'm actually working with tzaddikim because the fact is they are locked up, so obviously they have trouble with law. But sometimes you can stay amazed of the amount of mysterious neighbors these Yidden have for every minig, every mitzvah, to fight for, to have, to be able to learn the chapel, the study room should be open the more hours possible. I had some amazing stories, mamish mysterious neighbors of Yidden in jail who willingly gave up a lot of other rights, like they said, I don't want visitors, I don't want anything, I need my tzitzit, I will not move. Like they did a strike, they were sitting at one place and on their beds, I'm not moving before I have my tzitzit. So they would give up their daily walk. I mean, people who are in locked up in the shoe.
Solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement, yeah. And sometimes when they were being put in solitary confinement and they didn't brought their tickets, I had a yid who went on strike. He was sitting days on the same spot and said, I don't want to move without tickets. At the end, they brought them their tickets. And so it's this, like this year all the time when I'm going with kids to visit their parents, and the father tells them, Shefila, please be better than me. Look, I'm in jail. I'm not proud of myself, but you can be better than me. It's like you said, no one wants to be there ever, but sometimes I want to be there, chuset. Even in the darkest moments, they have this mysterious message.
You know, they say over a story that the Heiliger Baditshiva, he used to invite into his house all the Ditzabrachana, Ditzaklapta, the smelly people, the homeless. And they would say to him, you know, Rebbe, it's not Lafi Kvaidach. He was the Rebbe of the city, too. He was the Rav of the city. It's not respectful. And he used to say, when Levi Yitzchak goes up to Shemayim, when Levi Yitzchak goes to heaven, and God is going to say, what are you doing here? He's going to say, Rabbeinu Shalom, by my table, I had the homeless and the smelly and the toothless and the clothless and the ganavim. He said, so you, Rabbeinu Shalom, you could take me in Levi Yitzchak too.
Wow, that's so beautiful. It's so, very true. We put in all the broken people in jail and hospital and old age home. We take them away. They're not in front of our eyes. We put them into homes. It's good because people need to be treated for whatever, for what they are. But the hard thing is that we walk around, those see happy people, but the world is not so happy. The world, there's thousands of people in jail, thousands of people in hospitals, thousands of people are homeless, and we don't see them, so we think they don't exist. It's very important to remember they exist and support those organizations who remember all the people who exist and we don't see them around.
So I want to thank you, a tzaddik, Rabbi Yoel Levin. Today he is the crowned as the Rebbe of the Tzabrachana, of the Tzaklapta Mishpachis. The Rabbeinu Shalom should give you kayach. You should be able to continue to do your wonderful service.
Thank you.
Well, it was nice to interview somebody in the same time zone for a change, as opposed to Australia or Israel, etc., the number of our last guests were from. Next week, we will have two fascinating guests. We will have Rabbi Uzeri, who is leading a charge to pay Rabbeim more, and our question will be priorities in tzedakah. Who does that extra money go to first? Does it go to Achnasas Kala? Does it go to the local kohel or to your Rabbeim? And we will have one of the Oiske Tzorcha Be'amuna, Rabbi Tzvi Glock. He will speak about the remarkable work he does for our Tzibur. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. This is David Lichtenstein for Headlines Radio.